Right, James Lubbock, his family lived a normal life in a very respectable suburb until one day his dad gave up a successful career, and what happened next is the subject which is unbelievable, and it's all 100% true. It's in his book, which is got to be title of the year, James, Breaking Dad.
Thank you, yes.
How you must have chuckled when you came up with that one.
Yeah, I think in some ways it was sort of quite obvious. I mean, I was a big Breaking Bad fan,
right.
But I just asked my friends, and two separate friends from different groups came up with the same idea, so I had to go with that.
Brilliant, brilliant. Let's go back right to the beginning here. From the impression you give of your father, it was an idyllic childhood. He was easygoing. He was a solid, stable guy. You looked up to him. He never raised his voice. The perfect father, in fact.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was, you know, he had his eccentricities, maybe the English eccentric.
Yeah.
But apart from that, he was stable, reliable. I looked up to him. He was principled. He was moral. He was a moral, sort of straightforward businessman that sort of was at the top of his game in that sense as well. And I admired him for that. So there was never any suggestion that there was a danger lurking in the future.
No, and you know that will become apparent in a moment. But if you were to give a profession that you thought would turn into what we're about to talk about, it wouldn't be a coin dealer, would it?
No, not at all. although, as I sort of refer to in my book, there are strange correlations and similarities with the way he did business.
Wow,
on both sides.
how interesting. So went to private school. You got a media degree at Bournemouth University. Very nice too. Lovely part of the world. And yep. You were called to dinner by your father, and he said he had something really important to tell you. Now, of course, that would probably strike terror into most kids' hearts that something awful would happen, like he was ill or something.
Yeah, I mean, I was in my early 20s at the time. I didn't like surprises. He was very an unusual thing for him to do, you know, to be that sort of dramatic, let's set it up for dinner. I thought he either had a terminal illness or a love child, but never in a million years could I imagine what he was going to tell me.
No, but he then announced during dinner that he was gay. Now, in itself, fair play to him. I guess relief, firstly, for you, but also happy that he had finally come out and could be himself.
Yeah, absolutely. I was shocked, but actually happy for him. Slightly sad to think that someone like that, you know, had lived a bit of a lie for a lot of his life. But I said, you know, you're still my dad, and I'm sort of proud of you for coming out, and you know, enjoy it. And I just said, you know, be safe. Really,
was
the only thing I could think.
Yeah,
really.
And the next bit you couldn't make up really, because 2 weeks later, your mum did exactly the same thing.
Yeah, she took me out to quite a famous restaurant, a Turkish restaurant in Soho called the Gay Hussar, which was ironic.
Yeah.
And, you know, I thought she just wanted to talk about it. But she told me, you know, she'd recently moved in with this woman. And I thought it was a little unusual, but they were both lonely. But no, they were with each other in a romantic way. And she was also gay. So a double shock.
Wow. So you must have expanded on this with them at some point. Had they always been gay, or was it something that they discovered after they were married?
They had always been gay. They'd always known from an early age. But, you know, if you think about it, they were born in the 40s.
Yeah.
And when they grew up, you know, in their 20s, it was illegal.
Yeah.
Plus, within the Jewish circle, it was even more conservative and more perhaps closed and more pressure to do the right thing. So I think they both felt they had no option. And they got married relatively late for that generation, but they just went with it, and that was it.
Amazing. And I guess then when you were growing up, there was no inkling in the family circle that either of them were gay. It was complete shock to you that both of them were gay.
It was. And what's amazing is that both didn't know about the other one until right up to the end. Now, a few friends of them had guessed a few years before that, and they sort of laughed and said, we were not surprised, but... The two, when you're so close to a situation, you just don't see it, I think. That's part of it.
That's it. So, crikey, let's just run that back a sec. So I thought that having been gay all the time, they got married as a kind of convenience thing, knowing that each other were gay, and just thought, well, we'll go with that because we like each other.
No, not at all. I mean, there was an element, I think they had a sexual relationship of sort. So, you know, there was something there. But, you know, they, as soon as they got the chance, they parted their ways and discovered their sort of the true sexuality.
Quite incredible. Wow. Now, that in itself is a pretty interesting story, but it's the next bit which really was the kind of must have been the big shock to the system. Did you spot before the moment that we're about to talk about any change in your father?
Well, I mean, from that moment on, that was the inciting event, you could say, because he then went headlong into the gay scene, which right. involved clubbing. You know, he was into classical and opera music, and then he got into hard house. He started smoking.
How old was he at this point?
He was in his 50s.
Wow.
It was like all these new drugs that he obviously never even existed when he was younger.
Yeah.
And he enjoyed it. And I was happy for him still because I felt he was sensible and I'd sort of experimented now and again myself. And I thought he's not going to go too mad. And it was a growing thing. So as a businessman, one day I went to his flat and noticed he had a big bag of drugs. And I said, what the hell are you doing? And he said, I just bought more because it's a better deal. And I just give some to my friends and I still save money. And he confirmed that he didn't take any money for it. So I sort of gave the benefit of the doubt. And then months further down the line, more and more drugs in his flat. And I confronted him again. And then he revealed that actually he was now giving to friends of friends and taking money. And that was a big, big, horrific shock for me because I then realized that my law abiding, you know, principled father was now unbelievably a drug dealer.
Indeed. And a big drug user. And for those who are not aware, I mean, crystal meth is a serious drug. I believe you melt it in a pipe and smoke it. Is that right?
Absolutely. I didn't know what it was when I first saw him doing it. I was, you know, I dabbled in a few bits and pieces, but this was an extreme drug. And I was actually a bit curious about it, but you're right. Absolutely. At the same time, he was becoming more and more addicted to the drug, which had a huge effect on his reasoning and being able to sort of just talk with him and his rationale, which was very frustrating for me.
So then the call came from a solicitor friend of your dad, and you, of course, again thought the worst. He was calling to say that something awful had happened to your dad. He'd taken an overdose or some such thing, but it wasn't that at all.
I thought, you know, I was always worried because the longer it went on, his health was deteriorating. There were times when he wouldn't answer the call for a week on end and I had to physically go to his flat to see him. And thankfully, he would answer the answer phone. You know, a client might turn on him, a drug addict. Yeah, he might overdose, whatever. Yeah. So initially, I was relieved that he wasn't dead. But then the realization of what I'm going to have to go through and he and everyone else with this arrest, it was a huge sort of finding for them, biggest amount of crystal meth in the UK so far. I was obviously extremely distraught. And that came one morning at work. And I was walking around Soho, just trying to take it all in. I gathered myself and thought, if I can go back to work and get through the day, then I can get through the next however many years this is going to go on for. And that's what I did.
Yeah. And so basically it came from a police raid on one of his flats in 2009. And detectives there found crystal meth worth £1.5 million. And it was a bit of there was an indignity attached to this, wasn't it? Because he was out cold in a chair, literally wearing just a tank top.
Yeah, I mean, he was literally caught with his trousers down.
Wow.
Which, you know, I mean, there's a dark humour to it's a very serious subject. He was also, I think he was saying he was watching The World at War, and 30 police officers smashed down the door expecting to find, you know, a typical drugs baron,
with
guns and everything, and they see this meek little Jewish man sitting in a chair watching a war documentary.
Wow, how extraordinary. Obviously then that was a serious business. He was jailed then the following year for 8 years, but served only 4 because of his good behavior. And again, I would think that you would have thought that when he went into prison, you've just said it, you know, he's a small 62-year-old middle-class Jewish man going to a tough jail, he would have been eaten alive in there.
That's what I feared. And, you know, I sort of considered when he was dealing and it was getting more and more out of hand, what were my options? And I sort of thought, you know, I could actually call the police myself. But one of the reasons I decided not to was because I thought he would just not last a day. But thankfully, you know, it didn't turn out that way. It saved his life, firstly, because he was off the meth. And he not only survived, but he thrived in there, which was a huge surprise, but for the first happy surprise in a while.
Amazing. And when you went to visit him, which I'm assuming you did at some point in jail, was he remorseful as to what he'd done?
He was remorseful. He was remorseful to how I had been affected and his closer family. You know, he was aware of this rash of criminality that he'd spread. But it was initially, it was more sort of, what have I done? What have I done to my son? You know, I was an only child. Mm. My mother had sadly, you know, died of cancer a year before he was arrested, which is also in the book. It's sort of a running theme. And it all spiraled more out of control after she died, because she was such a rock to him.
Yeah.
And I was sort of just essentially left on my own, and he'd then gone off and done this. So, it took a time for him to process. And to be honest with you, he's had to reprocess it again with this book and rereading it all, which probably wasn't the most pleasurable experience for him.
No, I'm sure. And was there an element, and you must have thought this, but did he think it, that he was dealing in a dangerous drug and giving that to people who could easily have just killed themselves or you know, been brain damaged for life?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was this absolute, you know, moral excuse for it. He did say that, you know, I don't sell to people that are addicted, and I make sure I give them the purest stuff, and I insist on weighing it. But saying that you're a moral, in quotation marks, drug dealer.
giving drugs to people who are not addicted is a slight contradiction in terms.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, I think he realized that in the end. He felt that he was, you know, if it wasn't him, someone else would do it. But that's not an excuse either. So there was, you know, but trying to reason with him when he's an addict, it's so, so difficult and so frustrating. And I just couldn't get him to see reason at all.
Yeah, absolutely. So he did thrive in jail, and it was almost a kind of rebirth. And when he was away from the drugs, he got back to being his old self. It must have been amazing to see for you.
Well, I can tell you that the day that he got arrested, that evening, he called me from the prison phone. And he said, "James, is that you?" I said, "Yes." And he just immediately, he was back to his normal self. I could tell by his voice that he was off it and he was fine. He said, "I'm so sorry. I can't believe what I've done. I love you." He wanted to tell me his prison number. So he remembered that. He was compos mentis enough to remember that. And yeah, we visited him in prison. I took my first eldest daughter, his first granddaughter, he met her for the first time in prison. And it was good to see him not only surviving, but sort of rediscovering himself. It was almost like a rebirth for him.
What was the reaction in the community? Because obviously in a Jewish community, they're very close-knit, and this is a kind of, it's a scandal that I wouldn't have thought went down too well.
No, it didn't go down well. It was such a shame, because he was regarded rightly at the time as someone that was very honest and principled, and there was shock. And, you know, how could this be possible within the coin dealing industry, which is a global industry, but very closed. Everyone knows everyone else.
Yeah.
He was a president of certain societies. He was regarded as one of the straightest dealers in the sense of, you know what you get with Richard Lubbock. And sadly, you know, obviously they ejected him from all those societies. And some people within the industry said, well, see, no one, you can trust no one in this industry, which is such a shame, because he was trustworthy. It's just he obviously completely went off the rails further down the line.
Yeah. And so he came out after 4 years. And tell us about him now. I mean, I believe that, you know, he's a little bit slower maybe because of all the drugs he's taken, but he's your dad again.
He is. You know, he's also in his 70s. And I've got to continue to remind myself of that when I get frustrated with him for forgetting things. But no, he's been very supportive. He's been involved in some of these radio and TV interviews. And he spends time with his granddaughters and goes to see classical and opera music. He was trying to convince me to go and see Tosca the other day, and I politely declined. But he's back and hopefully he's enjoying his life. He's a bit worried about turning 70. He had a bit of a late life crisis, but overall back to his normal self, which is obviously a generally a happy ending. There is an element of redemption in the story.
There's not much more of a juxtaposition than hard house music to Tosca, is there really?
Don't think so, no.
and in the book, you know, you're very clear about it. You know it is irresponsible. You know it was terrible. But the book is a story about how things can go completely wrong and everything looks completely black, but they can be fixed and they can be put right.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I go back through it and people say, you know, I can't believe what you went through. And in a sense, I can't, but you sort of tend to get through these things, and people have been through much worse than I have, you know, so it's all relative, of course. But I think, you know, hopefully people will read that and see there's always hope. And there's always a chance to turn things around if you have the right attitude and just, you know, approach it in the right, sensible way.
Amazing story. I really appreciate you being so honest, James, for coming on and telling us about it. The book is called Breaking Dad, brilliantly titled, and it's available now from our TRE bookstore, from our website. Thank you ever so much, James. Appreciate your time this morning.
Pleasure. Thanks.
All the best. Bye. Yes.